On this episode of Let's Talk, I sit down exclusively with Lead Yes Network host Bob Lorenz. He brings his distinct humor right off the bat.
Bob, great to see you.
Thanks, Jacob. You said it's exciting. That makes one of us.
On the addition of Jack Curry and other analysts to the Yankees pre- and post-game show.
The great thing about Jack, and I'll say this about every guy I work with, actually, but like Flaherty, too, when they first got into it with us, into the business, I could tell from show one, like, they're going to be just fine. They're going to be great because you could see that they were, I wouldn't say, like, totally relaxed because, you know, you're new in television.
Sure.
You know, it's different, but you could see that they would never be blindsided by a question they couldn't answer, you know? And that's a comfort level for me, that I know that I can ask them anything, and I don't feel like I'm setting them up for failure. I'm going to set them up for success.
And did he know the Yes Network would be as successful a business venture when he started there 13 years ago?
Yeah, I really did, because you could see that the production quality, the people they hired, John Filippelli with the pedigree that he has in the business and at networks, and Woody Fryman, Ed Delaney, you could see that they were about quality and about putting people in the right places. They spent money to make money, and it paid off big time.
Bob Lorenz exclusively one-on-one coming up right now on Let's Talk.
Really excited to do this on really the eve of the baseball season underway spring training-wise, but I know it's an extraordinarily busy time for you. Bob Lorenz, the host of the Yankee pre- and post-game show, really the lead studio anchor for Yes. Bob, great to see you.
Thanks, Jacob. You said it's exciting. That makes one of us. I'm kidding.
Yeah, sure.
Come on. You put that on a tee for me.
I know.
To take that shot.
I know. Well, I think the first time we met, you came into the meeting and said diversity is a ship, or that Anchorman line.
did I use that one?
I think you used that.
Yeah. Speaking to the interns every year, I try and break out a variety of Anchorman lines. And then the past couple of years, because Anchorman has been sort of dormant and,
yeah,
you know, I haven't been using those quotes. And now Anchorman 2 just came out. So now I have a whole new material for the interns.
Arsenal.
Yeah. Yeah.
I went to HR. I was concerned.
As well, you should have been. That's how that got my file.
You know, what is this, year 13, year 12? I get confused.
Baseball
season wise.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's 13 this year coming up.
Right.
Yep.
So lucky 13. Obviously the team changes.
Mm-hmm.
Does the preparation change? Does the mindset change year to year?
You know what? The mindset doesn't change because I think we kind of have the same mindset every year, that we always feel like we do a good job, but we always say, like, how can we be better? You know, let's take some of the things that didn't work last year, make sure we don't do them, and try some new things. You know, I think working with Jack Curry a lot in the studio, obviously, we're always trying to get better. And, you know, we get 30 minutes prior to the game, and we get, you know, as much as an hour, hour and a half post-game if it warrants it. And we just look at it segment by segment and say, how can we make those the best possible viewing moments for our audience?
What's been the discussion this offseason and how to make it better?
You know what? Truthfully, there haven't been a ton of discussions yet. We do a lot of those things when we get down to Tampa. Now, Jack's down there now. I don't go down till March. We have a production meeting in March. So a lot of that will start to sort out over the next few weeks. You know, it's nothing drastic. It might be new graphics. It might be we're going to try and do a little more of something, a little less of something. You know, what wardrobe is Jack bringing to the table that I have to outdo him on? Obviously. I mean, that would be number one on the list. The man's a sharp dresser, but...
Well, we talked about your ties, though, which are an internet sensation.
Right, right. Well, I'm not sure about that, but I'd like to think so. Thank you.
Too high-maintenance talent people just, like the two of you.
But it was so easy when it was just me and Studio Jacob, but now I got Jack sitting next to me, and he's a dapper man. He looks good, and I'm always like, I look at him, seriously, over the past... 3 or 4 times we've worked together on like the Tanaka press conference and a couple other things, he'll show up and I'm like, you got a new suit, didn't you? That new shirt? He's like, yeah. I'm like, that's solid. That looks really good. So, you know, got to step up my game.
He's in baseball mode.
He's already in baseball
postseason mode, really.
Yeah, yeah. He keeps the postseason mode all year round.
Flash seems like a sharp dresser.
He is. Yep.
Cone?
Cone is actually. You want to hear a great David Cone story?
Yes.
This was from last year. He was... He'd been out in the Hamptons, and he lives in the city, but obviously our studio is here in Stamford. So instead of driving to the city to pick up a suit, because he was in studio for a couple days, he just drove right to a men's clothing store, bought a suit, shirt, tie, the whole shebang, and just brought it in here. So I still have the pants that he never wore with the price tag on them, because he just bought a suit. And
just for
he ended
fun.
Up wearing the shirt, tie, and jacket on there that night. It looked great.
Well,
yeah. But David Cone can do that kind of thing.
It's like he's. It's like it's the seventh inning, and he's right. making the in-game adjustment.
Right, exactly.
So, and I guess with Jack, I mean, it is a dramatically different show when you add the second person.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I'll tell you two different things from the technical aspect for me. You know, the pregame is the only scripted show we do.
Mm-hmm.
But when Jack's there, there's like nothing basically in script or in prompter. You know what I mean? It's just, here's where we're going, and I can tee him up and set him up for anything. And so that's what makes it so fun, is you feel like we love doing post games, because the post game is fly by the seat of your pants,
right?
You know, that kind of thing, reacting to the stories. With Jack there in studio, we have an idea where we're going, but you know, if I want to ask him a follow-up question, or you know, he has something he wants to ask one of the guys, if we're talking to the guys in the booth, we can do it. We can adjust on the fly. That makes it fun.
And you know, when you look at the post game, I know it's always been unscripted,
mm-hmm.
but were you always an ad-libber? You know, I mean, you were doing local news and then CNNSI, but
right.
This seems like, truly, you have to be so quick-witted.
Yeah, I've always kind of been that way in terms of responses or thinking of, hopefully, something, as you said, witty to say or that can add to the broadcast. Yeah, I guess I've always kind of been that way. But, you know, some of the stuff in the past I've done has been scripted and some hasn't been. And then, that, you know what, that's part of the fun of this, too, is when you're doing that in unscripted television, you have more of a license to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
And how are you, you know, you've always mixed in the humor, which, you know, is obviously mm-hmm. natural. But is it, you know, when the highlights, you know, you'll have the one-liner. Do you study that sort of craft, or is it...
You know what, I'll tell you a difference between now and when I worked at CNN and CNN Sports for a long time, was that we used to get those shot sheets a lot with a little bit of a lead time, not always, but sometimes. So then we could really kind of work on maybe some lines or whatever. Here at Yes, usually I'm not getting those shot sheets till right before I do them. So there's, if I think of something on the fly that might fit or is funny, I'll throw it in there. But you might see a little less of it than you normally would, because I'm just kind of reading the shot sheet and reacting to that, reacting to the play itself.
But then there's, when you see something,
yes.
and then the movie reference clicks.
Oh, absolutely.
And within 2 seconds, the brain's processed it, and it's coming out on the air.
Yeah, and you know what? It's a lot easier, too, if I give up a little bit of the highlight to, say, Jack mm-hmm. or John Flaherty, mm-hmm. and then while they talk, I come up with something and I'm able to hopefully articulate that and be witty.
Were you involved in bringing Jack? Did you want that two-man show?
Yeah, you know, I didn't really know that that was going to happen at the time. I'd worked with him before because he was on some of our hot stove shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was going to leave the Times and started talking to a variety of media outlets. And he liked the familiarity. He liked, I guess, me a little. I don't know. I can't verify that.
That we can verify he doesn't like
it. Yeah, okay, good. Just the way I want it. And... yeah, but once I kind of heard that this was a real strong possibility, I was like, yeah, please bring him in. It just adds so much. And right, you know, the great thing about Jack, and I'll say this about every guy I work with, actually, but like Flaherty, too, when they first got into it with us, into the business, I could tell from show one, like, they're going to be just fine. They're going to be great, because you could see that they were, I wouldn't say, like, totally relaxed. Because, you know, you're new in television,
sure.
you know, it's different. But you could see that they would never be blindsided by a question they couldn't answer, you know. And that's a comfort level for me, that I know that I can ask them anything, and I don't feel like I'm setting them up for failure. I'm going to set them up for success. That's attributable to their knowledge of the game.
How do you develop, John Flaherty and Jack Curry are two different people,
mm-hmm.
as many of the analysts you work with. How do you develop the chemistry, the comfort level, beyond what looks like a natural potential for them to be successful?
Yeah. You know what? Truthfully, it's hanging out with people and getting to know them and knowing, you know, kind of what buttons you can push with them to have fun. You know, you never want to go somewhere with them that would make them uncomfortable. So if you're hanging out, you have dinner with somebody or lunch with somebody, you kind of learn that, you know? There have been times where I've had conversations with John, Jack in the gym, or, you know, just kind of chatting, Jack in here in my office. There have been times where we'll sit an inning at a time and not even speak. We're watching the game, we're writing notes, and then we'll bring up something that happened that day or happened with his wife or my wife or, you know, our families. And you just, again, it's time you get to know people and then you know what you're comfortable with. And I'd like to think now that that comes, as you said, comes across on the air. Very relaxed, very natural, that we truly get along because we do.
And during the game, I know Jack keeps score.
Mm-hmm.
And not that you're not watching the game.
I do. I keep score.
You keep score.
Yeah.
So I imagine the banter is probably, Jack's a pretty focused guy. I mean, mm-hmm. Is there a little bit of banter or?
No, that there is. And there'll be times where, you know, we'll bring up something that may have happened on the show earlier or something. I mean, there have been plenty of times where something will remind me of, let's say, something that happened to my son. So I'll talk about, I'll tell him a funny story about what happened to him or my daughter, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
Or something that happened in his day that day. So again, it's like we're just kind of sitting around having dinner, watching a game, you know, that kind of thing. So some of it's personal and some of it's professional. Yeah, when we do talk.
How did Forbes Sports Money come about?
That was kind of a understanding between Forbes, the Yankees, our management here. So from their end, Miguel Forbes, Steve Forbes, from the Yankees' perspective, Randy Levine, the president, and from our perspective, John Filippelli and Woody Freiman, they kind of all put their heads together and said, yeah, this could be a good show to do. And how do we do it and not make it so that it were just boggling people's minds with numbers and stuff that the average viewer wouldn't understand? When I say that, I throw myself into that group. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll sit here in pre-show meetings sometimes, and Michael Ozanian, who's my co-host,
yeah.
He's the national editor with Forbes magazine. He does all the valuations for all of the professional sports teams. So he is a numbers guy. He's a numbers cruncher. We'll bring bankers in, and we'll bring all these guys in. They're throwing some lingo around and some terms. I'm just like, oh, what? What does that mean? What is the, you know, what's the ROI? Oh, return on investment. Okay, yeah, I get that, you know. So they're just throwing stuff around sometimes. It just boggles my mind. So I look at it from the perspective of how can we make it so accessible to the viewer out there so it all makes sense, and how I'd look at it like this. Whatever we're talking about, how does it impact me as a viewer? And then I transfer that to kind of those guys and have them answer those questions.
How do you make it accessible to the viewer?
You know, I think we always try and look, well, like I said, keeping the numbers simple. Instead of getting too deep into EBITDA and ROI and all of these valuations, saying, okay, what does it mean to the viewer? How does, let's say, the Dodgers' new television deal, which is valued at over $8 billion, how does that affect the guy sitting at home? It's going to cost him more money, probably. Is it going to get on cable systems? Where is any of the average viewer going to be able to see it? Those sorts of things. How does it impact the viewer? And so I hopefully ask those guys questions that they can answer with regard to that.
I imagine there's a balance, though. It's probably drawing a fairly well-educated audience of also business professionals. So you don't want to talk down to them, I guess?
Yeah, no doubt about it. But here's my thought on that. They would understand it if we had all the technical talk about their business. But they're sitting at home relaxing watching a show. I don't think they want to be doing that either. They want to hear the broader spectrum of what it means. And I've had people that have worked, I'm thinking of, I've gone to restaurants. I went to the DMV one time, and the guy's like, oh, you do that Forbes Sports Money show. I love that show. And I'm like, wow, you're kidding, really?
Yeah, right.
He's like, yeah,
right.
No, it's really good. I really like, you know, the banter and the whole thing. And I'm like, wow, that's great. So it's a wide spectrum of viewers, yeah.
Were you always interested in that sort of sports business genre?
You know what? Only as probably as interested as you would have been or the average person. I mean, it's interesting to hear of TV deals being done and that sort of thing and valuations of teams. But, I mean, the honest answer is no until they brought it to me and I said, oh, I'd love to do that. I think it'd be great. And it has been.
And it has gotten so much more attention over time. I mean, the TV deals are such a relevant part of how these teams are constructed.
It's what is basically driving cable systems and teams and increasing the revenue and values of teams exponentially. I mean, everybody thought the Dodgers, the new ownership group, was crazy to pay over $2 billion for that team, and they just got an $8.5 billion TV deal. Basically, their payroll and everything else is covered on an annual basis of over $300 million in this TV deal. So, yeah, it's unbelievable how live sports programming has become so key, and that's not changing. In fact, we just taped the Forbes Sports Money today, and one of the things we're talking about is how the new CBA and the new impending TV deal for the NBA has increased NBA team valuations.
Right.
I mean, 2 years ago, we were talking about you would not want to touch an NBA team. You'd be crazy to put your money into one. And now guys are jumping on them, hedge fund guys, investors, not just because they want a trophy. Oh, look at my shiny trophy. I have a team. It's because they see the upside here is incredible. I'm going to invest $400 million, and I'm going to end up selling this team for $800 million. That's a good investment.
And even in doing the few years of it, you probably can see the evolvement. The trends are happening so fast.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievable. Every show now, we seem to talk about a bigger and better TV deal, a bigger and better team valuation. Yeah, it's all plus, plus, plus increases as opposed to a few years back when the market was down and things hit right. In 2008 and 2009. Everything was down. It's all back up.
And talking about the evolvement of the TV in general, mm-hmm. Let's go back 2002. You're at CNNSI, been there for a while.
Yep.
When you're coming, or this opportunity, first of all, how did this opportunity present itself?
Actually, if you remember, I think we've talked about this
yes,
before,
yep.
but the original anchor was Fred Hickman,
yep.
who I worked with at CNN for years here at Yes, obviously. And I was closing things up with CNNSI at a nice little severance package. And I was sitting there looking for my next opportunity. And lo and behold, about 2 months after flipping the switch here at Yes in 2002, Fred was the only guy that was on air for him, and he was getting worn out, and he was getting laryngitis, and so they asked him, who would you bring in? Do you have somebody you can recommend? He said, give Bob a call, and which was great of him, and so they called me and said, would you mind coming in, filling in on a Yankee series for Fred? And I said, absolutely, and just that first year I did about 50 events for him. Second year I did about 100, and I was commuting back and forth from Atlanta. Still, my family and I were living there. And about that third year, in 04, they said, we have enough for you to do up here. Would you consider moving up here? I said, yeah, absolutely. So lo and behold, that year, Fred had another opportunity to go to ESPN, and I moved into the main seat.
Did you think back then... Because Yes was really at the, mm-hmm. the forefront of this regional sports network, team-owned network
right.
conclave, that this would be as successful business-wise as it has been?
Yeah, I really did, because you could see that the production quality, the people they hired, John Filippelli with the pedigree that he has in the business and at networks, and Woody Fryman, Ed Delaney, you could see that they were about quality and about putting people in the right places. They spent money to make money, and it paid off big time. You know, we do everything and always have network quality. Mm-hmm. You know, nickel and dime, and it shows in the product we put on the air.
Coming from being a California guy,
mm-hmm.
obviously moving all over the country, was it still an amazing thing to, not that you're a professional, you've done network television, but to say,
right.
wow, I'm going to go do the Yankee, you know, pre- and post-game. Do you ever even today pinch yourself and sort of, I mean... It's such an organization.
Yeah,
it's iconic.
You know what? And that's another reason why I thought that the network would succeed, because it was attached to the Yankees. There is that cachet, that platinum standard, if you will. You know, the only time I've ever thought that. Trust me, I know I'm lucky to have this job. Very fortunate, and it's great that the Yankees are attached to it. The only time I've ever felt that was my best friend, Mike Kirsch, and I were talking one night, and I have started, at this point, you know this, I've started to do a little bit of play-by-play uh-huh. during the regular uh-huh. season. So we were talking one night about something, and he asked, well, what'd I do? And I said, I'm on the road. I did a Yankees game. And he goes, dude, do you realize? He goes, you just did play-by-play for the New York Yankees. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I get that. Like, I don't think of it. I just think of it as my job. But in the grand scheme of things, when he and I were sitting back in L.A. playing Little League Baseball, watching This Week in Baseball and watching the games of the week on Saturday and NBC, I never thought I'd be doing that. Listening to Vince Scully all those years, I never thought that I would be doing that, no less for a team like the Yankees. And so the fact that I get a couple opportunities every year to do that and to be their studio host, yeah, I don't take it with a grain of salt. But that's the only time it's ever sort of struck me. Now, I will tell you this, too. The other time it dawned on me was getting to work with guys that I grew up watching. Bobby Mercer, for example. Ken Singleton. You know, here I am standing next to them as peers, so to speak, in the television business. But to know that I'm basically dealing with these legends of the game. David Cohn, Al Leiter. that hits you. And then when I did a show for a few years, and I think you know this, with Yogi Berra, Yogi in a Movie.
Movies, yeah.
I mean, this is a guy that was not only iconic for around my time, but certainly my parents. So, you know, pick up the phone. Hey, Mom and Dad, yeah, I've got a new show on tonight. Why don't you check it out? I'm working with Yogi Berra. You know, like, well, I'm sorry, what? Yeah. Yeah, I'm working with a living legend, Yogi Berra. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure it's always a fine balance. And I was even reluctant in trying to figure out how I would craft that question because you're a professional. You're never overwhelmed by the moment.
Right.
You do your job at a high quality. And you never want to seem like I'm in awe of the product.
Right.
But
yeah.
At the same time, as you say, you're working with these people that maybe are in awe of the some of the personalities.
You know what? You don't think about it on a daily basis. You just do your job. But when you think about it big picture like that, there are those little moments that are just like, that's pretty cool. I get to work with these great people. I get to work with people who have forged a legendary name. And when you can't look past that. You can't look beyond that because it is a pretty cool thing.
Conversely, I think people always have the perception Yankees are involved, they're dictating the content. What, if any, is there any input from the team or are you guys working totally?
We really know. We really just kind of do our own thing. And I think they know that given who we are, they can trust us with the product. I mean, we know we're here protecting, I won't even say protecting, dealing with a certain brand in the Yankees. We're not going to do anything to throw fire on that and gasoline. I mean, that would be silly for all of us. But we, as journalists, look at it and say, okay, if there's an issue that needs to be addressed or something that is a hot topic, we should address it. And we do.
And I imagine the moments keep the job fresh. In this case, it's Jeter's retirement. Mm-hmm. It's been Mariano's retirement. It's even a death of someone where you're entrusted with that duty.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, you know, in the course of a regular season, you think the players always say it's a grind. It's 162 games, that kind of thing. So some days the stories, not much. It's a 1-0 game. Some days the stories are incredible. But you're right, over the past few years, you know, Posada retiring, Andy Pettitte retiring and then coming back.
Right.
You know, Mo, we knew all last year, so that's a story to follow all year. Jeter will be this year. You know, the return of players, Mark Teixeira, Jeter, who didn't play much last year. Just all those storylines. So there is always something that on a day-to-day basis, maybe you don't chronicle it every day, but then bigger picture, you look at it and say, this is going to be a big story all season. We'll follow it.
How about the involvement of the Nets as a brand on the network?
Yeah, I mean, it's been huge this year. Obviously, just moving to Brooklyn was step one. That was kind of a cornerstone. And then you start cementing in around that the new players that they got, the commitment by Mikhail Prokhorov to make the team better. And then finally, the players themselves finally coming together in the month of January, playing better basketball and being more watchable and being interesting. And they have become that, and that's a good thing, obviously, for them, but for us as well.
We've gone back to 2002. I want to take you back. I forgot which, whether it was in L.A. for that CBS subsidiary or the, what was the job where you were with a couple of buddies in like a farmhouse or something, or you were in some crappy living locale to start off.
Was it Eureka, California?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah,
that
well. Now, let's not upset the people of Eureka, California. It wasn't crappy. It was just, first TV job was, you know, I made nothing in terms of wages. It was an opportunity. Small town, you know, fishing and timber and covering local sports and running around with a camera and shooting 3-4 high school football games on a Friday night and coming back and editing them and that sort of thing. And what's funny about that, you mentioned it, like, you know, living in the town, you know, wasn't probably where I'm going to retire, but I would say that you look back on those times as very fond times. You know, a lot of people do in their first jobs, and it was a crazy opportunity, you know, just to be able to, I was sports director, I was a one-man band, again, wasn't making a ton of money, wasn't making really anything at all, but you look for the opportunity, how can I build on that? And then the relationships you formed and the things you did. I mean, we used to, if you would picture a very small set. Oh, you know what? I know where you got the farmhouse reference. Our set was inside like a gigantic farm shed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that, and we'd do an 11 o'clock show, it'd be pouring rain outside. We'd hear it on the roof, you could hear it on the air. It's incredible.
I just mix. I mix. Yeah. You know, the thoughts get all jumbled. Farmhouse. And I just throw them out. Farm, like a Ron Burgundy. Yeah. I like farm.
Do you really like farm, Jacob? Or are you just saying that you like farm?
Well, I could go into the pants party thing, but then the podcast would get.
Yes, but the other, I don't know if I told you this story, but it was a small set, and it was just picture it as being like a normal set with what basically would look like the weather wall was left field, where the news anchor sat was center, and where I sat was right field.
Okay.
So after we get done with the 11 o'clock show at night, and it was a crew of like two camera people, an editor, producer, director, and then the news person and me, right? So we would turn all the cameras around so we couldn't break them. And we would sit there and play wiffle ball inside the studio. And it'd be just like one-on-one, and we'd call the shot, like, oh, that's a single, that's a double, that's an out. And we would, our weather wall, we didn't have like a green screen type technology. It was so ancient. So our weather person actually took a Sharpie and wrote the weather on this plexiglass.
Okay.
So that thing, it was in left field, and we would hit shots off that, and it would just be like, wah, bah, 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 like just so loud, and we're like, we just couldn't break it though. It was plexiglass, not like we were trying to break it. We were great.
I was going to say, did you want to break it?
But it was fun. It was great. It was like hitting a shot off the Green Monster, you know, putting a dent in it. Except we couldn't dent the plexiglass.
Have you brought that up as a post, you know, after a long extra inning show to do that? A yes.
too much expensive stuff to break.
Okay.
Up there. Yeah.
You've matured. Yeah, so right. Proud of you.
No, I'd still play wiffle ball. Yeah.
You do?
I've actually played wiffle ball with Jack Curry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where?
At his house.
Oh.
He is a huge wiffle ball guy.
Okay.
So he used to have this, he's since moved. I think he can play wiffle ball in the new house. I haven't been invited to Curry Manor yet, the new one. But the old place had this gigantic backyard and then a pool, which was basically center field. So we called it
Jack's doing well.
Curry Cove.
Wow.
We called it Curry Cove.
Okay.
So we got out there one day. He had a party and we were over there. And he had his nephews over, and, you know, his brother-in-law and his brother. We had a great, I think we fielded two full teams. Yeah, and we played a great game. It was fun.
Have the other professionals, the Cones and Flashes, gotten involved in these?
I'm trying to think if the Flahertys
were
there.
That'd be quite a team.
The Flahertys may have been there. Cones were not, though.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're trying to get them involved.
Right.
Play golf with David Cone, John Flaherty.
You're a big golfer, right?
I try to be. Yeah, big disaster, but yeah.
I try. Well, disasters are like respectable disaster.
Disaster. Yeah. High 80s, low 90s.
Well, that's a nice day. You play, you do, you know, shoot 9 or 18, and then you go do the show?
I have time to get an 18 if I get up early and go out and play, which I got a buddy locally that he likes to get up early. He has young kids, so we go out, we'll play early, and I'll have time to, you know, decompress, clean up, and then get into work. Yeah.
Mike Hirsch, you mentioned him in a couple of the, one of the other interviews. This was your best friend from childhood who stayed your best friend?
Yes, third grade. We went to high school together. Let's see, how can I connect the dots quickly? We were at Cal Poly Pomona together playing baseball. He left a semester before me to transfer to USC. I helped him with a TV project.
Yep.
And I went back and told my dad, I said, I got to go to USC. You know, I'm not going to make it as a baseball player. I know that. So this is my future. And he said, if you can get in, he goes, I'll make it happen. So I did. He did. And that next semester, I transferred, roomed with Mike. We shared an apartment for 2 years. And we both got our degrees in broadcast journalism. And he ended up going into news. He's an investigative reporter and a documentarian. And I went into sports.
Hmm. Yeah. So he's in the business?
Yes, he is.
Gotcha.
Yeah. He's a freelance reporter.
Yeah, and sorry for not knowing not memorizing the exact chronology. It goes Eureka, then to Southern Cal.
Eureka for a year and a half.
Right.
West Palm Beach, Florida for 3 at the NBC affiliate there. I was the weekend guy, the number 2. CNN for 13 years.
Right.
And then up here for the last, almost that now.
Yeah.
God, I mean, I haven't been up here. I've been up here since 2004, but yeah, this will be, yeah.
I guess you never know in television because, I mean, you could be let go at any moment.
Yeah.
But did you think, if I say 13 years ago, you're going to be here for this long?
No, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day who was with me at the same time at CNN, and he's here. Well, Jeff Quagliata, head of research and development. He was down there, too. We were talking about, like, can you believe that it's been almost as many years that I was at CNN, because that was a long time, 13, as it has been up here. I never would have thought that at the time. But, yeah, it's pretty amazing. Time flies.
Did you feel each move was a progression?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There, I had a couple opportunities when I was in Eureka. I interviewed for jobs that were local markets that were very lateral. And I looked at it and I said, I have a choice. I can either keep taking jobs wherever just because it's a new job, or would other news directors rather look at my resume and say, this level of the market, people are very flighty, but this guy is stable. So instead, I stayed. I had my first opportunity, was about 6 months after being in Eureka, to go somewhere else, and I didn't take it. Then I had a couple other ones that, again, were very lateral. So I stayed in Eureka for a year and a half. And I think that may have had a little bit of an impact for a news director to say, oh, a guy would stay in a small market that long. And, you know, so maybe he's a guy I can trust a little more. He's not going to bail on me. He's not looking for the next best thing. So that helped me. And I, the places I've been are always treated me right, West Palm Beach. And then I knew a couple of years into that that I might have an opportunity coming up at CNN. So, again, that stay, I sort of knew what was coming after that.
How do you know that they reached out?
Yeah, actually, the way that happened was there was a woman who was visiting her parents in Boca Raton, and she was an agent. She called me up one day blindly and said, I like your stuff. Keep working on your stuff. I have some friends at ESPN and CNN and, you know, whatever. I said, okay. So I, about another 4 months, I kind of worked on my style, whatever that is, and sent her another tape, and she's like, yeah. She's like, what's your situation? I said, I don't know. You know, I have, like, 4 months left on my contract or something. She's like, yeah, I'm going to see if I can make something happen for you, and maybe we can do business. I said, okay. So she did.
Without even you being the client yet, she took enough of an interest.
I basically became a client at that point. Yeah.
Right.
She's like, let's work together, and I felt good enough about her and her track record, and I'm like, great, let's, you know, if you can make it happen, make it happen, and she did.
You bring up a fascinating point about the not taking a job laterally, because I heard when Matt Lauer was on Center Stage, he brought up that here was a guy that was unemployed for like a period of time.
Right.
Doing whatever in Massachusetts, but that some of the jobs that, or some of the decisions that were most important were the jobs he didn't take. And I think sometimes, especially now, because the industry is so competitive, people are like, take whatever opportunity.
Yeah.
And maybe that's right to an extent, but it is interesting to think about, maybe it's smarter to really, you know, you really do have to evaluate each thing individually.
Well, you do, and I think as you look at the way the TV business has changed, when I got in, it was go to a local market, work your way up locally, and then jump to a network if you can. Now, because a lot of the local markets have cut sport, I'm just speaking from sports perspective, but it applies to news as well. They've cut sports budgets, they've cut how many people they're going to employ. The guys that were in market 20 and 30 are now moving down to market 60 and 70. Those are jobs that as a guy 1 or 2 years into the business I was looking for at that time.
Yeah.
So the dynamic has changed as to how you, you know, a route for a lot of people now is do what you're doing, podcasts. I know you do radio too, but, you know, doing internet stuff and working and getting reps doing that, and that can lead to television if somebody sees it, as opposed to, again, go to market 184, go to market 100, go to market 47, you know, that sort of thing.
No, the creation of a brand is different.
Yeah.
We can talk about that in the next
You know what's funny about that is when I started in this business 25 years ago, I never thought about creating a brand. That's a thing that has sort of come up.
Yeah.
That term
right.
in the last, what, 5-10 years probably?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I never thought about I need to create brand Lorenz. You know?
But you're savvy. I mean, you're on social media. You're
dinosaur. I mean, I totally get it. I'm just saying that everybody thinks about that now in building a brand. And, you know, how many people do you see on reality shows that within 2 months of being successful, they're coming out with their own clothing line and, you know, that sort of thing. So it's amazing. They do anything they can to build a brand. It's such a buzz phrase now.
Yeah. What did it mean when you won those Emmys? The New York Emmy?
You know, I'll be honest with you. It means a lot, obviously, getting some recognition. But I take more pride in the team ones that we win. To explain to anybody who doesn't know, I happened to win 3 in a row for best sports anchor
in
New York.
I should explain that.
No, I know. But I differentiate and mention that because I like the team ones. I like winning for Forbes Sports Money. Because, you know, it gets recognition for a show that's a niche show, that's different. It gets recognition to my co-host, Michael Ozanian, for, trust me, he does a lot of the heavy lifting on the show, and our producer, David Alfords. You know, the pre and post game, if we win an award for that. I love that kind of stuff because it's all of us. It's not just me, you know. I mean, I could sit out there and talk and win awards, and that's great, but I'd rather the team win.
You've done play-by-play now, ventured into that.
Mm-hmm.
Are there goals that you set of things you still want to do?
You know, I've always said this. I'm lucky with the jobs that I've had because I really like what I'm doing right now. You know, I look at some of the guys that do it on a daily basis and how much they travel and that sort of thing. And even though my kids are out of the house now, it's not something I want to do right now. I like studio work. I love the people I work with here. But I also get that little break a couple times a year to get out on the road, kind of cleanse my palate of the studio, and go do something different and find a different challenge. Somewhere down the line, do I want to do play-by-play for a team more consistently? Maybe, but that's not where my mindset is right now.
And I even meant, you know, not even from a leaving to do something, but mm-hmm. just within the company, I mean, there's just, who would have known Forbes Sports Money
right.
was there? So I didn't know if something in your head...
Yeah, I think there are probably other shows that I could do. There are other shows that I have done at the network that other people do now.
Right.
Because it became like the Bob Network at one point, and there I am. We don't want that.
But. It's three letters.
It's easy, right?
It's easy to put in the corner.
It's Bob.
Yeah, right.
And you can't spell it wrong because it's the same backwards and forwards. So, but yeah, I mean, we've thought of other shows, and we've kind of pitched them, and, you know, apparently it's not someplace they wanted to go, but... But anyway, I like what I'm doing right now, and if they want me to do something else, I'm always open to it.
What do you do, and you've always seemed like a pretty measured guy, for fun, you know, really mm-hmm. to disconnect from the work?
Golf,
mm-hmm.
Love food, so my wife and I go out to eat a lot, more than we should, probably. Travel, love to travel, love anything with a beach. So, kids live out in California, so we go out there a lot.
Ty's graduated?
He is graduating this semester, actually.
Okay.
In about 2 months.
From Arizona State?
February, March, April, May, 3 months. What's that?
Arizona State. Okay.
He actually does it all online now, graduating in film and media studies. Yep. He switched from Chinese. He's burned out on Chinese language, so he said, I'm getting into film and media studies.
Okay.
He loves to write. He loves to create. So he's doing that. Yep, daughter's out there doing the same thing. And living right by the beach, so we get out there a lot. And it's very familiar turf for my wife and I because we both grew up out there. So get to see family and see the kids.
Where'd your wife grow up?
She grew up in the same area, Southern California.
Okay.
We met in high school, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, this has been fun.
Jacob, thank you. It actually turned out to be fun for me.
Yeah, you really came in with a very... skeptical perception, and it wasn't appreciated by the whole staff, by any of our Let's Talk.
The staff, how many are on the staff, by the way?
Well, we don't reveal it.
Do you have a president, vice president? Is it a producer, executive producer? Are we talking 50, 100?
It's all those people in one body.
Oh, really?
It's just me, doing all, yes.
So is somebody else going to interview me in just a second? Somebody else?
It's a revolving door.
Yeah.
You know, we're constantly taking people on the fly. But no, thanks. Appreciate continued success.
Anytime. Thanks,
Jake. It's always fun.
All right, man.
Thanks again to Bob. Of course, you can see him throughout the year on Yes's Yankees pre- and post-game show, Forbes Sports Money, and other programs. That's all for this episode of Let's Talk. Coming up next time, we get a behind-the-scenes look at trying to break into the radio business when you're 40, with Greg Schneider, a producer and engineer with WFAN and the CBS Sports Radio Network. For now, though, I'm Jacob Wilkins. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.